Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, the flu season is deadly and ahead of schedule, and many emergency rooms are packed.
3 weeks ago, 28 patients tested positive. Last week, it was 58, and this week, so far, it's 119. So there's a lot more influenza that we're seeing in the community.
So why is the U.S. scrambling to buy vaccinations from Canada and the U.K.?
Also, a victory for accused dirty bomber Jose Padilla.
And an incredible Christmas gift to mill workers in Maine, a $1,000 bonus for every year of employment.
My sister even has worked there for 18 years, and she said it was just unbelievable.
These stories and more are coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. A federal appeals court has ruled that President Bush does not have the power to detain an American citizen seized in the United States as an enemy combatant. In a 2-1 ruling, the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the release of Jose Padilla within 30 days. The ruling could force Padilla to be tried in civilian courts in a dirty bomb plot. He's been held incommunicado in a Navy brig. Another American soldier has died in Iraq, this time in an ambush northwest of Baghdad. The military says insurgents fired small arms at a military patrol. Another American soldier and an Iraqi interpreter were wounded. A member of a major Shiite Muslim political party in Iraq has been killed outside his home in Baghdad. Loyalists to Saddam Hussein are suspected in the attack of Mohammed al-Hakim. He was in charge of security at Iraq's education ministry. NPR's Ivan Watson tells us this type of attack has happened before.
The killing of Mohammed al-Hakim is not the first time somebody from the Hakim family, an official from the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, has been assassinated. Last August, there was that devastating explosion outside a mosque in the southern city of Najaf that killed the leader of this Shia Muslim U.S. allied party. His name was Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim, and he has been revered as a martyr since that death. He was the leader of a party that holds a seat on the Iraqi Governing Council. In fact, his brother, who is still alive and has also survived an assassination attempt, he is now the chairman of the Iraqi Governing Council.
NPR's Ivan Watson speaking to us from Baghdad. At least four Palestinian militants were killed today by Israeli troops in the West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian officials say a fifth man, a civilian, also died. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Both Israeli and Palestinian officials said there were heavy gun battles in the old city of Nablus, where Israeli troops were searching for Palestinian militants. At least three armed militants were killed in a clash with Israeli troops, and a fourth, a member of Islamic Jihad, was shot dead when he allegedly tried to plant a roadside bomb. Palestinian officials said a fifth man, a baker, was also killed in the fighting. An Israeli army spokesman said a Palestinian planning a suicide bombing was arrested in Nablus. The violence comes hours before Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is set to deliver a major policy speech in which he is expected to detail unilateral steps Israel will take if the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace fails to take hold. Linda Gradstein, NPR News. Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 58 points to 10,203. The Nasdaq's up 21 to 1942. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, the Federal Communications Commission has issued its first citations for violations of the Do Not Call list. The FCC has warned California-based CPM Funding that it will face fines of up to $11,000 per customer if it continues to contact people who have placed their names on the list. CPM is also known as California Pacific Mortgage. A gauge of future economic activity was up for the second straight month in November. The business research group, the Conference Board, says its index of leading economic indicators rose 0.3% last month. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The rise in the index is just the latest sign the economy, which saw strong growth in the third quarter, is likely to continue expanding into next year. The index is designed to predict economic growth 3 to 6 months down the road. The board says 6 of 10 indicators that comprise the index were positive last month. That included an increase in weekly manufacturing hours and a rise in expectations on the part of consumers. It also showed weekly jobless claims declining, something that's continued into the current month, with reports showing first-time unemployment claims last week falling by a much stronger than expected 22,000. The conference board also revised upward its figure for October. Since falling to a record low in April, the board says the leading index has now risen nearly 6 full percentage points. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, the Chicago Federal Reserve says its national activity index jumped in November to its highest level since March of 2000. It says much of that is due to rising manufacturing output and positive reports from purchasing managers. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, all over the country, it's standing room only in many emergency rooms as people continue to come down with the flu. All over the country, too, there's a shortage of flu vaccine. We'll have the latest on that in a moment. But first, we're joined by Dr. Alastair Khan, head of the emergency room at busy Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Welcome, doctor.
It's good to be here.
Doctor, how long have you been at Mass General working in the emergency room?
Oh, I've been here for 15 years.
Wow. Have you ever seen a worse flu season?
No, this is about the worst I've seen it. This has been earlier in the season, and the patients seem to be sicker than we've experienced before. We do testing, and I can give you the figures. 3 weeks ago, 28 patients tested positive for influenza. Last week, it was 58, and this week, so far, it's 119.
Who are the patients? Are they old? Are they young? Everything in between?
It's basically a mix. About 50% of them are in the pediatric age group, and then about a quarter of them have been over 65.
There are masks being handed out in some places, in some emergency rooms. How about yours?
Well, certainly, as you come into the emergency department, what we're asking patients to, if they're coming in with a cough and sneezing, we give them masks to cover their faces just until they can be seen and screened.
What are you telling people who come in who you decide do have the flu? What do you do if you got the flu?
Well, certainly if somebody comes in and their vital signs are normal, or they may have a low-grade temperature, but they're able to take fluids by mouth, we can certainly test them. But the vast majority of people, even if they test positive, 90 to 95% of them will send them home.
I see.
Take lots of fluids, take non-steroidals, Tylenol, Motrin for the headaches and the muscle aches, and the vast majority of these people will get better.
And then it becomes a real problem for someone who is admitted with something being exacerbated by the flu. For anyone else, they have to be put in a kind of a secure area on a floor so that this very contagious flu doesn't make nurses and doctors and other patients sick.
That's correct. We have about 20 patients today in the hospital with influenza, and hopefully we won't go very much above that. But because if we do, then we may need to look at where are we going to accommodate these patients and perhaps slow down elective surgery, for example, so that the hospital can accommodate the patients.
Wow. For most people, although there's a lot of publicity around this flu season, there's really no need to worry more than you ordinarily would about the flu. There are ways to cope with it.
That's correct, yeah. It is certainly a bad flu season, but we do not expect, this is not an epidemic in terms of lots of people dying. There's a lot of media attention, but it's the flu. We'll get through this.
And you've been through a lot in a big city emergency room. You can handle the flu season. Dr. Alistair Khan of Massachusetts General Hospital. He works in the emergency room. Dr. Alistair Khan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, as we just heard, this flu season has arrived ahead of schedule, and the outbreak has sent even the needle-shy in sometimes frantic search of a flu shot. But what's the latest on why there's a shortage of vaccine, and why are federal officials trying to scrape some up in Canada and in England? What went wrong? We're joined now by Dr. Frank Sloan, a professor of health economics at Duke University. Dr. Sloan, welcome.
Thank you.
Doctor, what's the latest on what's believed to be the reason for this shortage of vaccine?
Well, the reason for this shortage is that the flu season came early and the demand surged. The supply was fixed at what was used last year. And there's just not enough vaccine to go around.
Yeah, last year there were 95 million doses of flu prepared, I've read, but only 83 million were used. Is there just no way to predict these things?
Well, I mean, there is a way to predict, but we can predict that on average we might have 83 million or some amount. The problem is the fluctuation in demand, and we need to be prepared to accommodate the fluctuation.
Why wouldn't federal officials err on the side of caution?
Money.
Well, when you say money, what do you mean?
I mean that that it costs money to stockpile.
Yeah.
And there's hasn't been enough public interest to allocate monies to this.
Is there nothing that can be done about this short of always storing too much vaccine for years in which not enough is used and having to throw it out and lose money in the process?
Probably not, but I don't think that's so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, restaurants buy food and throw it out every evening, you know, because they don't want to be short when the customer comes in.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily a matter of life and death. Let me ask you, Dr. Sloan, about another reason given most recently in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that an explosion of lawsuits has driven vaccine makers from the market.
Don't believe that. And also, we don't have good data on that. The industry has complained about litigation. On the other hand, there is a program, a no-fault program, that was passed in the 1980s just to address that issue.
Doctor, it's not just flu vaccine, is it? There are 7 vaccine shortages, apparently, in the past 2 years. Is this part of a larger pattern? We're simply not erring on the side of caution when it comes to vaccine?
This is part of a larger pattern, even though the reasons for the shortages differ. This shortage is really excess demand. Some other shortages have been production glitches or a firm has left the industry. In general, what this speaks to is that we need to have a vaccine policy, which we don't have.
Think that'll happen, or we'll just get through the winter and move on to something else?
Well, I think the worse the epidemic, the more likely it is to happen.
Yeah.
We deal at best when we have crises. When we don't have crises, in fact, a few weeks ago, before the flu epidemic, I went to a conference and they said that the industry was just doing fine.
Hmm.
There was no problem. Obviously, nobody would really say that today.
Dr. Frank Sloan joined us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Sloan, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Last week, employees at SAS Shoemakers in Pittsfield, Maine, were called into a meeting. They all expected to be laid off or told the factory was closing. After all, very few shoe companies now survive in New England. But instead, they were each handed $1,000 for every year they've worked for the company. It's a Christmas bonus that's reverberating through this small town, and Marie McNichol is a waitress at Simmons Family Restaurant where many of the SAS employees eat, so Marie knows. Marie, what's been the talk of the town?
Oh, everybody was totally shocked. It was a great surprise. My sister even has worked there for 18 years, and she said it was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, and there's only about 4,000 people in Pittsfield, and I'm imagining that in the back of your minds with your joy for these people that you know, you might also be thinking they're going to be spending it in town.
Right. especially with the snowstorms we've been getting. People are shopping, you know, right in town the last few days. So
that's great.
It's great.
The company has four other manufacturing plants around the country. At each one, they had the same surprise in their paychecks. But we understand that the founder and owner of SAS is from Maine, and that means a lot to people.
Yes, and he's always done stuff like this. It was a big thing to look forward to Christmas. He gave away cars and snowmobiles, and he's always been a generous man.
His name is Terry Armstrong, and he has said that he will never close the factory in Pittsfield as long as he's alive. Aside from this extraordinarily generous gift, what does that mean to the town?
Well, it employs a lot of people. I mean, and they, you know, are really grateful that they have a job to look forward to, considering the way things are going.
Right. Did your sister tell you what she's going to spend her money on?
She went out and bought a new dinette set, and she's just doing a lot more for Christmas.
That's right. For the kids, I mean, the kids in town must be overjoyed.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's quite amazing.
We understand that people have actually been flooding the SAS phone lines because they want to buy the shoes to support the company.
Right, all over the country, they had to put a new girl on just to answer the phones. They were getting so many calls.
Isn't that something? Well, Marie, thank you very much, and Merry Christmas.
You too.
Marie McNicola, waitress at Simmons Family Restaurant in Pittsfield, Maine. Well, Pittsfield, where the SAS Shoemakers Factory is located, is small-town America. Brick storefronts, a population of about 4,500, a scene that hasn't changed much since the 1930s. But many of America's main streets have changed dramatically because of malls, highways, chain stores. Joining us on the line is Robert Polin. He teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And Professor Polin, how important is a company like SAS Shoemakers, you know, with personal ties to the town, where at least one of its factories is located?
Well, it's extraordinarily important. It's the basis for building a binding community. And we are, after all, with economics, with economies, we're also creating communities. We're creating the ways people live. It's not just about profits. It's not just about finding the cheapest way to do things. So it's really an extraordinary thing what SAS has done.
Well, it's a good story. It's certainly a good Christmas story. It's a quaint image that many people have. But what else tangibly does it do when a company stays or pledges to stay in a town?
Well, it creates cohesion in the town. People can build their lives around that. They don't have to worry about looking for jobs elsewhere. They can start building all the community institutions, the schools, the churches, the things that make people's lives worth living. They get reinforced by these kinds of commitments of companies, as opposed to feeling persistent pressure that their lives are about to collapse when the company moves out of town.
Is this the phrase we've been hearing, local living economy?
That is a nice phrase. I hadn't heard that phrase. I guess it comes out of the phrase that has been on people's lips recently, which is the living wage. Having a living economy is, of course, the basis for having people in the economy earning a living wage. So it's a wonderful phrase, and it reflects on the things that I hope that we can build on more generally.
What do you see, though, as a trend? I refer to a place close to home for many of us, Harvard Square, where many of the small shops that gave the square character had to move out because of chain stores moving in, driving up the rents. But now we're hearing that some of the chain stores, HMV Records, for instance, are not doing the business they want, so they're moving, leaving these huge empty shells. What kind of trend are you seeing? Is it back to these small local living economies?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I would like to say yes. I would hope that we can do that. The point that SAS, I think, reinforces for us is that their example is possible. It doesn't mean that it's happening. It doesn't mean that it's prevalent. It's possible, and that if communities really care and the businesses care about investing in the communities, it's not something that is beyond the reach of a community or a business. It just means that the businesses and the people in the community have to make decisions that reflect the needs and the desires of people in the community and not always just the absolute bottom line. Mm.
And as we just heard, the money that Terry Armstrong, the owner of SAS, gave to his workers is going to turn around and go right into that town.
Yes, that's going to go back into the town, and then people are going to have more to spend, and that'll multiply throughout the town. The benefits will spread even more broadly than the generosity, the direct generosity of SAS Shoemaker. Mm.
Professor Poland, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Poland, founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
There's more coming up, including an appeals court's ruling this morning in favor of alleged dirty bomb plotter Jose Padilla.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Could Iraq yet fly apart, separate into the three regions Winston Churchill welded together into the Iraqi state in 1921, which he did only to protect British oil interests? And if the Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish regions that make up Iraq were no longer under one flag, would that be such a bad thing? Leslie Gelb recently called Iraq a false state in a piece he wrote for The New York Times called The Three-State Solution. Mr. Gelb is president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Mr. Gelb.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Leslie Gelb. And joining us to disagree with Leslie Gelb's analysis is David Mack, vice president of the Middle East Institute and a former undersecretary of state. Welcome, Mr. Mack.
Good afternoon, Bill.
Thank you both for joining us. Leslie Gelb, let's begin with you. You think Iraq should be split up and the United States should help that happen. In fact, you call Iraq a false state. Explain.
Well, it is a false state and a failed state. And what I say is that the United States ought to move toward a three-state solution. In fact, I don't say actually get there. It's something to be held over the head of the Sunnis, because I see that as the strategic key here. Right now, we're making all the tough decisions because we're fighting this insurgency, essentially in central Iraq, essentially in the Sunni triangle. And I'm not sure we can win that insurgency.
So, Leskel, this is a device to sort of balance things out, show people what the real state of play there is, show Iraqis what the real state of play is.
It's to put the monkey on the Sunnis' back and to get them to decide whether or not they're going to bring the insurgency under control and assume a good and rightful place in a confederal Iraq, let's say, or whether they are prepared to keep fighting that insurgency, isolate themselves, and become a part of the past, not the future.
So when you published a piece in the New York Times called The Three-State Solution, that's a bit misleading?
Well, the headline was Three-State Solution.
Yeah.
The content said what I just said now. Move toward it and use that as leverage in bargaining with the Sunnis.
David Mack, what do you think of holding over the Sunnis the possibility of the state breaking apart and that the Kurdish region would become much more autonomous than it is already, and the Shia, who are, after all, 60% of the population, would become much more autonomous than they are already?
Well, Bill, with due respect to you and other members of your profession, I think that this description of Iraq in terms of Sunni, Shia, and Kurds is greatly oversimplified.
Mm-hmm.
Each community is far more diverse than this would indicate. And that's particularly true for the Shia Arab majority, who are in fact divided many, many ways. And the primary political identification for virtually all of the well-educated Shia elite is not religious. it's something else. And they form alliances across lines with people in the Arab Sunni community and Kurds as well. The real division in Iraq today is between secular Iraqis and religious Iraqis.
Right. The population very much does mix there. And as you point out in one piece, a Mesopotamia-centered state has waxed and waned, as you put it, for thousands of years. What about that, Leslie Gill?
Well, I agree with some of the things David Mack, who is more of an expert on this part of the world than I am, I agree with some of the things he said, but I disagree with, I think, one of the central points. There are Iraqis, Shias, Sunnis, Kurds, who see themselves as Iraqis. But I still think there is a powerful national identity, North, Middle, South, and that the Kurds, for example, are not going to allow themselves to be put under the control of a Baghdad run either by Sunnis or Shiites. I think that day is past.
You know, part of the problem here is the cure would be far worse than the problem. You would have you would have to have forcible movements of population and ethnic cleansing on the scale of what you saw in the Indian subcontinent at the time it was partitioned between India and Pakistan.
Do either of you believe that if any of the three regions was offered a state of their own, they wouldn't take it? They would prefer to be part of a bigger Iraq?
Well, Bill, there's a lot of popular sentiment among Kurds to have a separate state. But the political leaderships, both of the major political parties in Iraqi Kurdistan, have decided over the course of the past decade that they will find and they can find their political destiny and political power for their leaders within some kind of highly decentralized federal state.
Meaning essentially autonomous, I agree with you.
But Leslie Gelb, you do have a somewhat dark vision of the future of the place. You write, the Kurds and the Sunnis are unlikely to accept Shiite control, no matter how democratically achieved. You're writing off the possibility, I think, that if there is a democratic election, as George Bush keeps saying he's moving toward in Iraq, which the Shia would almost certainly win since they're 60%, that this is a country that could possibly glue itself together and have a coherent, unified vision of anything.
You read me exactly. You're right. Because if you don't have confidence and trust in one another, you're not going to turn over power to someone simply because they win an election. Because they can take everything away from you. Hitler won an election, too.
Leslie Gelb, what is your sense of whether anyone in Washington is thinking along the lines of your piece in the Times, the three-state solution?
Yeah, my sense is that almost nobody in Washington likes what I put forward, that it's too big a jolt from where they think they are. You know, as I said, the key to me is bargaining with the Sunnis, and I want to do it in a tough power way. I don't want to do it believing that democracy is going to solve all these problems. I don't believe it will.
Leslie Gelb is President Emeritus at the Council on Foreign Relations. Leslie Gelb, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, enjoyed it. Enjoyed talking with David.
And David Mack is Vice President of the Middle East Institute. Thanks so much, David.
Not at all.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, filmmaker Errol Morris and former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara on the new documentary about Vietnam, The Fog of War. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a loss for President Bush, a victory for the man accused of plotting to build a dirty bomb. The courts say charge Jose Padilla, bring a case against him, or let him free.
Also,
we'll talk to Padilla's attorney, Robin.
Also, the jury continues to ponder the fate of 18-year-old Lee Boyd Malvo, who faces the death penalty if convicted for his role in the Washington sniper shootings.
And Canada's Jane Siberry lends her angelic voice to the hymns of Handel and Bach.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. A federal appeals court says President Bush does not have the power to detain an American citizen seized on U.S. soil as an enemy combatant. Jose Padilla, a former Chicago gang member, is accused of plotting to set off a dirty bomb, which uses conventional explosives to spread radioactive material. A three-judge panel in New York says the administration cannot designate Padilla as an enemy combatant without authorization from Congress. A U.S. soldier from the 1st Armored Division was killed in Iraq when his military patrol was ambushed northwest of Baghdad overnight. Another soldier was injured, as was an Iraqi interpreter. The soldier's death brings the number of U.S. troops killed in combat to 314 since the war started. It was the first fatal ambush of a U.S. soldier since Saddam Hussein's capture on Saturday. Officials are warning that more insurgent attacks are likely in Iraq, even though Saddam Hussein is in custody. Lourdes Navarro reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. military and civilian officials have been saying that they do expect attacks to rise in the wake of Saddam Hussein's capture. It happened when Uday and Qusay Hussein were killed, and they are expecting it to happen again. There has been an upsurge in violence in the Sunni Triangle area, with protests getting violent.
Meanwhile, a Baghdad newspaper with Saddam Hussein's picture on the front page flew off the stands today. It shows Saddam Hussein, shaven and in captivity, sitting on the floor while being visited by three Iraqi governing council members. Former Secretary of State James Baker is in Russia, the final stop on his mission, seeking help in relieving Iraq's debt burden. Russia is Iraq's biggest creditor, with Baghdad owing Moscow some $8 billion. Baker, acting as a special envoy for President Bush, meets today with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier today, he got a pledge from Britain to support U.S. plans to relieve Iraq's debt. He's also gotten assurances from France, Germany, and Italy to work toward debt relief. President Bush spent about 2 hours getting his sore knee scanned this morning at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. Doctors are trying to determine what's causing him pain. MRI scans were done on both knees. While at Walter Reed today, the president also paid a visit to U.S. soldiers wounded in Iraq and to Secretary of State Colin Powell, who's recuperating from prostate cancer. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 55 points. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A man who allegedly plotted to detonate a dirty bomb, a crude nuclear device, was taken into custody in a storm of publicity in the spring of 2002. Jose Padilla, a former Chicago gang member, was declared an enemy combatant by President Bush himself. But this morning, an appeals panel in New York City has ruled that the government does not have the power to detain Padilla, an American citizen, presently being held in a South Carolina brig. Well, we're joined now from New York by Andrew Patel, one of Jose Padilla's attorneys. Welcome, Mr. Patel.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Before we get to the significance from your point of view of this ruling by the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, remind us who your client is.
My client is an American citizen who was initially arrested by the FBI in Chicago last May on a material witness warrant issued by a judge, Judge McKaysey, sitting here in New York City, which is where my office is.
What are the charges against him?
He has never been charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
He has...
He's an enemy combatant.
That is what the president declared him to be last June.
Accused of plotting to detonate a dirty bomb, Mr. Patel. Serious stuff.
Absolutely.
What do you make of that charge?
What I make of that charge is that as an American citizen, he should have the right to defend himself in a court of law.
Is that essentially what the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said today? What did this three-judge panel rule?
What the panel ruled is that the president on his own does not have the authority to designate an American citizen seized in the United States as an enemy combatant without congressional authorization. And what the panel ordered is that Mr. Padilla either be released or that he be charged with the crime or be held as a material witness, but that he be entitled to the rights under the Constitution that every citizen is entitled to.
Now, President Bush declared Jose Padilla an enemy combatant. Was he prosecuted at all yet by the government?
Never.
Who brought the lawsuit then to the level of the Court of Appeals?
The lawsuit, we filed a writ of, Ms. Newman and I filed a writ of habeas corpus seeking his release. And it was, that is the lawsuit that was just decided by the Court of Appeals.
I see. So what do you think happens now?
The ball is now in the government's court. They have several options that they can take. One is they can ask the entire Court of Appeals, the entire Second Circuit, en banc to review it. The other thing they can do is they can ask the Supreme Court to review it. The third thing they can do is they can comply with the order.
Do you expect this ruling to have an effect on other cases?
There is another gentleman who is not an American citizen, but who was a lawful resident named Mr. Almari. This case could have some impact on his situation.
Has Jose Padilla himself at all reacted to this? Have you spoken to him?
I have never met Mr. Padilla, and I look forward to meeting him.
I see. Could he be freed, just to finish up? Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility, but not a probability.
Andrew Patel is one of Jose Padilla's two attorneys. Mr. Patel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
The jury in the trial of accused Washington sniper Lee Boyd Malvo may return a verdict today. Malvo is being tried for the shooting death of FBI analyst Linda Franklin last October. He was 17 at the time. If convicted of capital murder, he could face the death penalty. In review of past cases, the Supreme Court has set the threshold of culpability far higher in capital punishment cases than in other proceedings. Well, joining us now is Jeffrey Fagan, professor of law and of public health at Columbia University. Professor Fagan specializes in the study of juvenile justice and adolescent crime. And Professor Fagan, what governs an adolescent's capacity to be held culpable for a crime?
Whether or not somebody is culpable for a crime assumes a level of maturity that most adolescents reach at different stages and different ages. There are many different components to maturity: impulse control and impulse regulation, moral reasoning, the ability to resist peer influence and influence by other persons who are not peers, perhaps adults, the ability to make social judgments about risk. Each of these is a component of maturity, and unless a defendant reaches that level of maturity and has those kinds of cognitive and emotional skills, that person may not be culpable, fully culpable for the crimes they commit. It's not to say that they're excused, it's just that they have not reached a full level of culpability.
Even if they pulled the trigger?
Even if they pulled the trigger. There's been significant new research by people who have been looking at brain development that suggests that adolescents don't attain that level of culpability until late into their adolescence or even into their early 20s. And that is research that's based on frontal lobe development, and the frontal lobe is the place where all of these functions seem to be regulated and where they develop. Mm-hmm. Assuming then that a young man who is at the late in his 17th year pulls the trigger in a crime, and yet he's mature in some aspects of development and he's immature in other aspects of development, that person may not be fully culpable according to the standards that the Supreme Court has articulated in a number of different cases. And so I would argue that the possibility exists of assuming that a young man is culpable when, in fact, he really may be immature in some significant ways. And that would be a mistake under current capital jurisprudence. There are many similarities between the conditions of adolescence with respect to immaturity and the specific capacities that attach to immaturity and the mentally retarded. And the Supreme Court, when they articulated when they said that mentally retarded persons should be exempt from capital punishment, mentioned some very specific behavioral capacities: the ability to regulate emotions, the ability to appreciate the consequences of your act, the ability to resist impulses, the ability to resist peer influence, for example. And the ability not to the special vulnerability of making false confessions. Mm-hmm. Well, if you examine the developmental literature about adolescence, virtually everything that the Supreme Court said about the mentally retarded actually does apply to many adolescents. Hmm.
Have you been following the Malvo trial enough to know if this kind of information was entered in?
I don't believe it was. I believe that the defense team took a very, very different strategy in the Malvo case. I believe the strategy, and my understanding is the strategy they took was something closer to an insanity defense, which is a very, very different set of social science and behavioral science issues.
Either way, Professor, it's very complicated. In the few seconds we have, it sounds as if the jury is wrestling with it as well.
Yes, it does sound like they're debating this quite seriously. I don't think anybody is going to contest whether or not he pulled the trigger. The question is, what is his degree of culpability? And it sounds like this jury is pretty well split.
Hmm. Professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Fagan, Professor of Law and Public Health at Columbia University.
Still to come, Canadian singer Jane Siberry on why she sings the hymns of Handel and Bach on her new Christmas CD.
Because it's beautiful. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our segment on the controversy over the possible over-the-counter sale of the so-called morning-after pill drew several responses. Patricia Burks of Philadelphia writes, "Missed in today's discussion of the morning-after pill was one critical fact. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, nearly 20%, one in five Americans, lives in a community determined to have a shortage of primary health care professionals, including the OBGYNs, family practitioners, and internists needed were the medication available by prescription only. The shortage means that a woman may have to wait to obtain a prescription. Coupled with the reality of millions of American women lacking health insurance, public policy must focus on giving timely, affordable access to medication."
Amy Lepak wrote after our segment on a perceived increase in autism, "You noted the increase in autism diagnosis without giving the perfectly logical explanation. Many people, especially those who want to see vaccines as a cause of autism, point to the huge increase in numbers without pointing out the change in criteria. Amy suggested we go to the University of Illinois website. It talks about older, more restrictive definitions of classic autism, as opposed to a newer, more inclusive autism spectrum that includes other syndromes. Amy says an increase in diagnoses of autism mirrors a similar increase in other illnesses in prior decades. Expanded criteria and increased awareness are the culprits, not some mystery.
Harriet Huey-Ranvig had concerns about the language used in our story on the science of implanting electrodes in the brain to help people with disabilities, who we referred to during the interview as both the disabled and quadriplegics. She writes, I happen to be blind, and I have worked at times in the area of disability advocacy, so here are my suggestions. Number one, replace the phrase the disabled with people with disabilities or individuals with disabilities. Two, replace a or the quadriplegic with the phrase an individual who is quadriplegic.
Quite right. Our segment with literary critic Steve Almond and chef Kathy Gunst on food writing drew plaudits from Barbara Ravage of Orleans, Massachusetts. Thank you, thank you, thank you. The only thing better than two people who savor the genius of Calvin Trillin is two people who see through the thin broth that is Amanda Hesser's Seductio ad absurdum. Skimming it once in the Times magazine was bad enough, the very idea of having to digest an entire book.
And finally, a couple of notes on music. Christina Marguerite listens to Here and Now on WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. She wrote asking about the music we used during a segment on miso soup. Well, Christine, it was the shakuhachi, or Japanese flute, as played by Kohachiro Miyata.
And several listeners wrote following our segment with jazz critic James Isaacs asking about the 3-CD set of the songs of Carl Sigman. Well, you can only buy it online at majorsongs.com. Here's Joni Mitchell's version of Answer Me.
Won't you say that we can start anew? My sorrow, now I turn to you. Please answer me, my love.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In 1984, a song blew across the border from Canada with such intensity it made me sit down hard.
I scan the horizon for you, Mimi. I scan for the both of us. I scan the horizon.
Mimi on the Beach, the first hit from Canada's singer-songwriter Jane Siberry, hooked a lot of people. Now, some 15 CDs later, she's back with a new Christmas album called Sushan, the Palace Hymns of Earth. The opening track handles How Beautiful Are the Feet.
How beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings. And bring glad tidings.
And Jane Siberry joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi.
How Beautiful Are Thy Feet from Handel's Messiah, and we should say he lifted it from the Book of Romans in the Bible, at least for the lyrics. I understand that this CD came from an epiphany you had when participating in the Downtown Messiah at New York's Bottom Line Club. You said you had a feeling about Handel you'd never had before.
Yes, I was leaning against the bar and hearing some of his songs, and I'd never heard him as a songwriter, only as like a classical composer. And that was an epiphany for me, and I started to love his compositions as songs.
You said you got a feeling that you'd only gotten before with pop music, that I get, for instance, from Mimi on the Beach. What is that feeling?
Good pop music, great pop music goes, it changes just at the right moment, and it changes to the right chord at the right moment, and it leads you through in a trustworthy way, and it's a very physically pleasing thing. Mm. And every time it hits one of those marks, you go, ah, that's great.
Right, the hook. Well, you were having that feeling while you were listening to another song, aria, from Handel's Messiah, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. Let's hear a little of that.
I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the last.
When a lot of artists record a Christmas CD, they tend to, pick traditional carols. And you went to Bach, Mendelssohn, Handel. Why?
It all started with Handel because of my exposure to the Messiah. And then I have my own record company now, an internet company, and I put out an email to people and I said, tell me the names of songs, like people who are much more in the know than I, what you would consider really beautiful old hymns. So a lot of these songs that I investigated were suggested by fans and or listeners.
Mm.
Things I would never have had the time or the exposure to find these amazing pieces.
And what did you discover about them in researching these men and this time? I mean, Hallelujah Chorus, for instance, means so much more to me, knowing that Handel just wept. I mean, when he wrote that song, he felt like he touched God.
Well, he hadn't eaten for 14 days either, or slept.
Well, I know. I laugh, but you're right. That added to it.
All these things were interesting to learn. And another thing I learned was that some of the accreditation is not that precise, and that it's been stated one way and carried forward. I guess it was for the Holst song, In the Bleak Midwinter. There's a version by Harold Dark, too, mm-hmm. where he's said to be the songwriter. But the Holst version goes, Dark's version goes, but they're still anchored to the same shape, and to me that's elemental to the essence of the song.
Mm.
So I disagreed with calling it Dark's version, Harold Dark's version. I called it Holst's version, with a few melodic changes by Dark. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow.
Speaking of little changes, some might say that you might be treading a slightly dangerous line, and that you left out in your recording of If God Be For Us, you omitted some lyrics. You write about it in your liner notes, but mm-hmm. you omitted some lyrics. It is God that justifieth.
Mm-hmm.
How did you justify that?
Singing If God Be For Us in New York, and it was just after 9/11. And the way I'd learned it was if God be for us, who can be against us? And I felt so uncomfortable singing that because it just seemed every comment like that had to be leveled into, again and again, no, he's not for anybody. We are all in this together. Everyone on this planet is in it together. And so there, it just seemed like everyone had to work at not separating people, bringing them together, people all around the world. So as I sang it, I was picturing everyone being in harmony. But later I realized I was emphasizing the wrong word, so I backed up for this version. If God be for us, instead of God be for us. That was a really important thing that I'd missed, and I'm so glad I caught it. So if God be for us, how can anyone be against us?
If God be for us, who can be against us? Who shall lay anything to the charge?
Jane Savory singing If God Be For Us. We have time for one last song, and I want to ask you, it's A Star Shall Rise Up from Jacob, that's from Mendelssohn, and by the way, he took the lyrics from Numbers 24:17 in the Bible. I wondered if you were ever in a church choir, because now you are a choir. It's like the Jane Choir, all the layering that's done. Did you ever sing in a choir?
No, I didn't. But I sang in washrooms with my girlfriends and smoked Rothman cigarettes since I was, I guess, 14.
That's sort of the same.
Yeah. Harmony. I've always loved harmony. I love pop music with lots of harmony in it.
A star shall rise up out of Jacob. A star shall rise out of darkness. Rise out of sorrow. Rise out of misery. A star shall rise up out of Jacob.
Jane Savory, thank you so much.
You are most welcome.
Jane Savory's new CD is called Shushan, The Palace, Hymns of Earth. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org. Before we let you go, what's Shushan?
Well, the record was going to be called Snow on Snow, a Christmas record, and I was reading the Book of Esther with my mother, and I saw Shushan, The Palace, and it just made the hair stand up on the back of my neck, and I said, oh, that's what it's supposed to be called. So I didn't question it. I just changed it then and there. And then I went on the internet later and looked up Shushan and found, to my surprise, that it actually means Lily, which is the working title of my next original record. But it's a beautiful sounding word, shush, and it has shush in it and hush and us. It's filled with words. It's a beautiful word itself.
Well, Jane Savory, thank you.
My pleasure.
And once again, for more information on Jane Savory's new CD, check out our website, here-now.org.
Let bring glad tidings, glad tidings of good things, and bring glad tidings.
Here and Now is a production of WVUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, one of the architects of the Vietnam War, speaks about the new film Fog of War.
And a critical look at how the press reported on Saddam Hussein's capture.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.